He's not coming tonight. So I'm your surprise guest teacher. Hi. Yeah. Thank you for that support and encouragement. Geshe Michael will ask me, I just got back from vacation, I'm slightly jet lagged, and Geshe Michael asked me to teach at the very last minute, so I got the information this afternoon. So if I ramble a little bit, you know, if I kind of go off on a tangent or start to drift too far, just let me know, okay? I'll try to get back to it. So I'm going to do the standard class in the standard way. So please have a seat. We'll take the first few minutes to meditate. Try to just shift your mind into neutral. Try to let go of all of your stresses of the week and all of your hassles and problems that you've been thinking about for however long you've been thinking about them. And try to just do a little bit of preliminaries, a little bit of breathing meditation, and try to get into a bit of a neutral space so we can think nicely. Loop. Okay. Well, yep. Alrighty. Welcome. I don't know if there are people who are new to the Friday night class. This class is usually taught by Geshe Michael, who is out of town at the moment. The classes are based upon a book which he has written called The Garden. And he's been going over the past weeks through the chapters and sections, just teaching from them and doing a little bit of explanation, elaboration. So I'm going to pick up where he left off 2 weeks ago at the last class and continue on. We're on chapter 8 now. I don't know if you all saw this, but apparently there's a prayer stuffing something Saturday afternoon. Learn to stuff a prayer wheel. Maybe it's like stuffing a turkey, I don't know. But if you're interested, there's the number. So, that's it for prayer wheel stuffing. So, where we left off was in a hot garden in the desert. It's where we still are, where we're continuing. We last left our protagonist speaking with the first Dalai Lama, and they were debating karma. You know, I guess you guys remember, right? Yeah? Okay. So, during the last section, the conversation between the master in the garden and the student in the garden was about, you know, what is this karma thing, and how does it work, and, you know, what's it all about, that sort of thing. So this time we pick up once again in the garden, and this time it is a different master who meets our man. We don't know who he is. Perhaps someone we know, perhaps not. Some anonymous protagonist in the garden who meets Master Gunaprabha, who is a master of the teachings on Vinaya, or an ethical way of life. And so he's gone there to have questions answered and to find out more about what he learned from the first Dalai Lama on karma and how karma works and, you know, how do you be ethical? What's it mean? How do you decide what's right, what's wrong? You know, what's good, what's bad? What should I do, what shouldn't I do? All those sorts of things. But before I go into that, the more important question is, why should we care? You know, in most philosophies or religions, it's, you know, people telling you this is good, this is bad, do this, don't do that, this is right, this is wrong, and if you do these things, you're going to burn in hell, baby. And Buddhism does it too. But, you know, no religion's perfect, right? But at least in Buddhism, they tell you, they have some explanations. You know, they have some basis. They give you some explanations as to why. You know, why should you care? Why should you behave in a certain way? What's the reasoning? What's the logic behind it? And you know, what's the outcome if you do or do not behave in a certain way? So, anyway, so before I go into that, I want to talk a little bit about the bigger picture, which is why care. A lot of people, when they study Buddhism, you know, they get into studying refuge or studying meditation or studying karma or studying various elements of Buddhism, and they don't ever really put it all together into kind of a big picture, into a more comprehensive whole, which says, you know, why do this or why not do that? Is it just because somebody said so? You know, is it just because it's written in a book? So I want to really kind of cut to the quick, and you know, in the event that you're really disappointed that I'm here instead of Geshe Michael and you leave at the break, I'll get the main point across. Okay? A lot of people I know, you look like, oh, don't think like that. But I hope I won't disappoint you. Anyway. In Buddhism, the main goal is to be happy all the time. More than just happy all the time, but to be in a completely blissful state continuously, forever. It would be the Buddhist equivalent of heaven, I guess you could say. You know, in the Christian heaven, you have you know, heaven and hell, where you got it made when you make it to heaven. Buddhism, it's similar in concept. If you become enlightened or attain nirvana, then you're in a very blissful, satisfied, extremely happy state forever. And the question becomes, you know, I think that's common knowledge. I think everyone has heard about nirvana, you know, at least has some idea, you know, if you make it to nirvana, you're set, you know, you're there. But the bigger question is, how do you get there? You know, how does it work? I mean, is it possible to simply state, what is this nirvana and enlightenment thing? And, you know, how do you get there? And what does behaving or misbehaving have to do with it? And, you know, therefore, should I care about whether I behave or misbehave? Because, you know, does it have anything to do with being happy all the time personally? So that's really the crux of it. And I think it's important that everyone understands very clearly how you become enlightened in a very broad conceptual sense. And having studied karma at the last class, hopefully you're at the last class, becoming enlightened is about your perceptions and how your perceptions work. Essentially, to be enlightened or to become enlightened, you have to perceive everything as a blissful experience all the time, 24 hours a day, forever. So, with all your senses, you know, if you are an enlightened being, that means that whatever perception you have on any level, whether it be seeing something or hearing something or smelling something or touching something or tasting something, it's going to produce in you an extreme intense bliss. The quality of that bliss and the nature of that bliss is indescribable for us, simply because there is nothing equivalent to it on this planet, or there is nothing experienceable which is close to that given our sensory capacities. So what it means to be enlightened is that, first of all, and to attain nirvana, is that first of all, you have this intense bliss 24 hours a day forever from the time you attain nirvana or become enlightened from then on. How do you get there? You know, how do you get to that state? How do you get to the state where feeling the breeze on the back of your neck causes the exact same bliss as the best chocolate cake you could ever have, you know? Or when you become enlightened or when you attain nirvana, there's no distinction between the quality or intensity of bliss. It's a complete, pure, ultimate bliss of which there is no higher bliss. So once you attain that level, it's not like you're going to have something which is feeling a little better. Everything feels good, but something feels even better, or even, you know, touching someone in a certain way is like the best bliss, you know, as opposed to eating something would be a little less bliss, or, you know, hearing the sound of a car horn would be even less bliss. If you're enlightened, each of those experiences produces the exact same level and type of pure bliss. Okay, so that's what it means to become enlightened or to attain nirvana. Whatever sensory input you have, no matter what it is, produces in you the exact same bliss. Looking at the color blue on this wall would produce in you pure ecstatic bliss. Hearing a door slam would produce in you pure ecstatic bliss. So, and on top of that, you're omniscient and you see everything in the past, present, and future, and some other details like that. But we care about the bliss. that's the relevant part, right? that's the part that everyone likes to focus on. So how do you get there? How does that happen? How do you get to a state where you're experiencing that? And that's about karma. That's about how karma works, and that's about the nature of perceptions and how perceptions work. So, as simply as possible said, your mind processes the sensory inputs it receives in a particular way based on the way in which your mind is wired to function. If your mind is configured to process data in a slightly defective way, you won't be able to hear very well. Or if you have a fault with your, you know, with that organ that's, you know, hearing. But generally speaking, in Buddhism, the way in which your mind is functioning, the way in which your mind is processing and interpreting data, determines your experience of an event. The exact same event can occur, a door slamming, and an enlightened being will experience that door slamming as pure bliss in their mind. And you, or I, as an ordinary being, will experience that door slamming as a somewhat unpleasant object. Now, why is it that an enlightened being perceives a door slamming as a completely ecstatic, blissful experience, and we don't? It's because the way in which their mind processes the data going into it causes them to experience that. So that's the idea. Does it make sense? I don't know, a little too mechanical, perhaps. But generally speaking, your mind has to function in a way where it interprets everything as bliss, no matter what it's receiving, no matter what your senses are taking in. So that's how you experience bliss. Well, it's not quite how, but that's the general idea. So how is it that you get your mind to behave in that way? How is it that you get your mind to interpret everything to be bliss as opposed to a pain in the butt? You know, how is it that you get your mind to interpret someone speaking to you loudly as either neutral or blissful as opposed to really obnoxious or unpleasant? You know, is it by force of will? You know, is it just volition? Is it just a matter of saying, if I try hard enough, I can do it? You know, I can... There, you know? Is it like that? No, it's not. It's a question of how your mind is composed or wired on a very subtle energetic level, on a very subtle level. So how do you re-engineer your mind? How do you reconfigure yourself or your thoughts so that your mind interprets everything in a different way? That's what we're talking about. Hopefully everyone can accept the idea that any given event can be interpreted many, many different ways. It's pretty obvious. Someone yelling could be a pleasant experience for one person, an unpleasant experience for another person. Someone eating the same food could love the food, someone else could really dislike the food. And you can say that of every single event that exists, from an extreme negative experience. You know, some being could experience, you know, a hot pot making a cup of tea as, you know, as a burning hell because there's a little bug running across the burner, you know, and someone else who's making the tea could experience it as a very pleasant event. So there's a whole spectrum of experiences which can be had around any given event. So that's the idea. And how do you and I get our minds to function in a way where everything that we experience is very pleasant, is very good? And the answer to that question is you have to do virtue. Doing virtue is the thing which configures your mind to be different than it is now. How does it do that? If you perceive yourself treating someone well, and this is hopefully, I wasn't here 2 weeks ago, I was away, so hopefully this is ground which was already covered. But if you, and if it's not, let me know and I can go into it a bit more. But if you, let's say if someone yells at you and you yell back at that person, you have had a perception of yourself yelling at someone, okay? And that perception of yourself yelling at someone plants an imprint, plants a karmic seed in your mental continuum, which turns into a result, an outcome, and an experience for you personally later. So every single thought that you have, every single word that you speak, every single action that you undertake, you perceive yourself doing, regardless of whether or not anyone else is around to perceive it. So the mere fact that you are perceiving yourself doing something imprints your mind, imprints your consciousness with that awareness. You have an awareness that you were kind to someone. You have an awareness that you were hurtful to someone or destructive towards someone or loving towards someone or whatever it may have been, down to the most subtle thought, down to the slightest thought of, this guy's a real jerk, man. You know, that's a karma you just collected. You just collected a negative karma thinking a destructive or unbeneficial thought towards another person. You know, why should you care? Why does it matter? It's because of the laws of karma. It's because of the way the laws of karma function in relation to emptiness, which say that any event can be experienced in many, many different ways based upon how your mind interprets it. And your mind was created by the imprints which you planted there. Your perceptions of yourself create your mind. And it's that same mind which takes and processes and interprets you and the world around you through your senses, and it creates, shall we say, your reality. Essentially, you know, you've got six senses to take in data with those senses, and you take in that data with your senses. Your mind processes the data, it processes the volumes and the colors and the shapes and the sounds, and it says, ah, I'm going to identify this experience as good, or I'm going to identify this experience as bad, or I'm going to experience this person as friend or foe or whatever your mind is going to process it into. And that's the basic nature of your mind. That's the basic nature of how your mind functions. Now the question is, what causes your mind to process its inputs, its sensory inputs, in the way in which it does? Why do certain people's minds process something into pleasant experience and others process something else into an extremely unpleasant experience? And the answer is that is based upon those imprints which you have placed upon your mind. You are, every time you have a thought, you are energetically imprinting your consciousness, your awareness, and shaping it in a way. You know, almost, you can say almost you're shifting your consciousness in the way in which your mind functions every time you have a thought. Or say something, or do something, and perceive yourself engaging in that. So what you end up doing through planting these karmic imprints, these seeds, is creating yourself in the future. You are planting the seeds which will turn into the future outcome and result. You are creating your future mind and your future mind's ability to process and interpret the data it receives through its senses. Does that make sense? I don't know. Does it? My. Okay, cool. What's going on here? I hope I'm not getting too far out there. So this is the general idea. And then the question becomes, well, you know, what is it that causes my... I should say one other thing, and that is, you cannot through volition or through conscious choice or will determine or decide that you don't want your mind to be a certain way, or you don't want your experience to be a certain way, and you would like it to be something else, you know? I mean, try to will yourself into being a, you know, an angel, you know? Or try to will yourself into not having, you know, an amputated finger if you had that experience, you know, if you had that perception. Try to will yourself into not disliking someone you've hated all your life, you know? It's very unlikely that you'd be able to do it, right? So how is it that you can change your mind? How is it that you can get your mind to function in a way where it interprets everything as a really fine experience? And this is what karma is about. This is what virtue and non-virtue are about. Hopefully most of you who were in last class, but the idea is that once you plant a karmic seed in your mind, once you have a perception, that karmic seed stays in your mental consciousness, your continuum, and turns into a result in the future. So every thought you have today, everything you say today, everything you do today, has been recorded by your awareness, by your consciousness, and it will shape who you are in the future, and you have no real choice about that. Once you do a deed, the result and the outcome is certain, you know. So if you believe in scientific life, if you believe in the principles of the modern scientific world, then you must also accept the laws of karma, that everything has every cause. How shall I say it? Every outcome has a cause. You know, science is based upon the principle that things don't happen for no reason. You know, you can investigate and determine what causes what. You know, that's what physics and all the other sciences are about, is investigating, okay, let's create an experiment where we can have the exact same result every time, given the exact same inputs every time. Karma is the exact same way. You know, you say, all right, this event occurred, and this is the outcome. And every time this event, every time this input or cause is present, you're going to have this outcome every time. It's a law of cause and effect, and it's inviolable. And it holds in the sciences, you know, and it holds in the laws of karma and perception as well. So it's like that. There's no escape. And I won't say more about it because that's from last class. So again, we're going back to virtue, non-virtue, good and bad, why you care, why should you do one versus the other. In the end, what you have to do is to behave in a way where you perceive yourself, let me say it differently, you have to perceive yourself behaving in a way where you see yourself benefiting people all the time. I don't know if that was very clear. You have to behave in a way where you perceive yourself benefiting people all the time on all three levels of your body, speech, and mind. You have to perceive yourself having thoughts 24 hours a day, nonstop, that are helpful to other people and to yourself. And every single thought which you have, or speech which you engage in, or deed which you do, which is harmful to yourself or other people, is planting a seed, creating a cause, which will bear its fruit, its outcome, and its result in the future. And, you know, if you're going to be in paradise 24 hours a day and in bliss forever, it excludes the possibility of a bad day, you know, or a headache once in a while, or, you know, things like that, the occasional problem popping up. So, and the laws of karma state that if you do a deed, you have to experience the result. You know, the nature, I'll get to you momentarily, Rebecca. The nature of your mind is such that you are having perceptual events all day long. You know, you're taking in data through your six senses and translating it into, conceptually processing it. Let me say this differently so it's a little easier. I'm jet lagged, so it's hard. You are having perceptions all day long. The only question for you is, how you interpret things. You know, will you have a perception of a pleasant event or an unpleasant event? You know, and what determines whether your perception of an event is pleasant or unpleasant? And that's your karma. If you've done something virtuous in the past, you'll experience an outcome as pleasant in the future. If you gave money in the past, you know, you will have a perception, you will have the experience of receiving money in the present or in the future. Those are the laws of karma. And they were covered in the last class, and I'm not going to go over it too much, but basically, you know, these are the laws of science and these are the laws of karma. A like cause produces a similar outcome. You know, if you plant cherries, you get cherry trees. You know, if you plant corn, you get corn plants. It's not possible to plant a cherry seed and get a corn plant. You know, it's the wrong seed for the wrong outcome. And the laws of karma are the exact same way. If you give, you receive. If you punch someone, you get punched. The correlation is unclear, and that's one of the problems of understanding karma, because there's a lag between when you plant the seed and when the outcome occurs, and it's very difficult to determine how long it's going to take for the outcome to return to you. You know, if you give somebody $50 today, you know, so let's say you go to some worthy social cause and you give them $50 and you say, okay, you know, here's $50. It's going to be, you know, some time, according to the laws of karma, before you see some money coming back to you. You know, maybe a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of years, maybe a couple of decades, maybe a couple of lifetimes. But the result is certain. You must get money back from having given money to other people. So it's like that. You have in your mind at present a perception, not on a conscious level, but on a very subtle level. You have in your mental consciousness at present subtle impressions from every perception you've ever had in your entire existence. You can think of it as the scales of justice, if you will. You know, you've got on this side, you know, you've got all these perceptions, which maybe you were helping people, and on this side, you know, you have these few perceptions of hurting people if you're lucky, right? The question is, you know, which is greater than the other? You know, do you have a lot more perceptions of yourself being kind and virtuous and helpful to people, or do you have a lot more perceptions of yourself being a real bastard? You know, taking advantage whenever you can for your seemingly own personal gain. If you have any karmic seeds, any perceptions of yourself hurting another person that can ripen upon you, then you will have an experience at some point in the future which is unpleasant. You know, if, let's say each of these karmic seeds represents a deed you did. Let's say, you know, this was punching Akmar 3 million years ago, you know, or 3,000 years ago, or whatever it was. You know, and this is, you know, stealing, you know, the $2 that you found on your mother's dresser when you were 6, you know, because you wanted some candy. You know, and this one was whatever. So let's say you've only got, you know, these few negative karmic imprints left in your mental continuum, in your consciousness. Each of those must still bear its fruit. You cannot escape the fact that these are going to ripen upon you. There is no choice, except you can purify them and eliminate them. But if you don't do anything with these negative karmic seeds, you must have the experience of them ripening into an unpleasant result. Well, guess what? You can't be an enlightened being or have attained nirvana and have any unpleasant results. If you have attained nirvana, or if you are enlightened, by definition, you will never have any unpleasant results. So what does it mean to be enlightened or attain nirvana? It means there are no more perceptions of negative thoughts, speech, or actions which you've ever done towards anyone. Okay? So, you know, very slowly we get rid of them, you know. Pretty soon. And if it goes the last one, you know. All right. Somebody just got enlightened. Wish it was that easy, right? This is what it means to be enlightened. What it means to be enlightened is you only have virtuous karmic seeds. You only have virtuous karma in your mind, in your mental continuum, so that no matter what experience you have, you can only perceive it as pleasurable, more than pleasurable, as pure bliss. And that is what it means to become enlightened, and that is how you get enlightened. And that's what Buddhism is all about. That's why I'm here tonight. Hopefully that's why you're here tonight. And that's the goal, right? That's the long, hopefully, wasn't so short, but that's the long and the short of the goal of Buddhism. The goal of Buddhism is to have only virtuous perceptions in your mind, in your mental continuum, so that you can never have a result occur which is unpleasant. You can never have an unpleasant perception forever, ever again in the future. And how is it that Buddhists stay Buddhists forever? Because they know that if they ever speak unkindly to anyone, ever, even for a microsecond, you know, they have to bear the result. They're screwed, you know. They're out of paradise. More or less, you know. But I'm being very loose here. But you got a question? Yeah. Can you... I didn't hear, I'm sorry. Right. Society. So the question was, you know, you have a perception of yourself doing something, and it's different than everybody else's perception. You know, everybody around you, society is saying, you're a real loser, man. You know, you're a real screw-up, or you're doing the wrong thing, or, you know, you're out to hurt that person. What are you doing? And you yourself, perhaps, are having a perception of trying to help someone, or doing the right thing, or being a good person, or whatever the case may be. That's the question, right? So, which is the important perception? Is that the question? Your own perception is the important element. And it's a very good question. It's a very important question. And that is, everyone's perception is unique to them. Everyone's mind is unique to them. There is no collective consciousness, you know. Your perception of what you're doing is what your mind is experiencing. Your mind cannot perceive the experience via someone else's eyes, you know, literally. You know, you can't be in someone else's mind experiencing it. You're only experiencing it from your frame of reference, from the perspective of you, your life, and your mind. And karma, that's one of the qualities of karma, is that it's personal, you know. It's you collect karma for yourself only. You know, everything you do is relative to you. And motivation is the main component of karma. Your motivation when you undertake something and when you do something is the most important aspect of karma. It is the main element which determines whether a karmic undertaking is a good one or a bad one. I hate to use those words, virtuous or non-virtuous. So you could set out to help someone and you could end up, you know, breaking their foot by running over them with a car or something, you know. Was it good or wasn't it good, you know, what you tried to do? You know, the answer is it was a mixed karma. You know, you had partially you did some good and partially you hurt somebody. You know, you perceived yourself doing both and you will have two results, you know, as the outcome of that undertaking. So, and it's a problem for a spiritual practitioner, you know, it's a very relevant question for a spiritual practitioner. You know, if you go out and you try to live your life in a way where you're saying, hey man, no matter what anybody says to me, no matter what anybody does to me, I'm going to try to be kind to them, I'm going to try to help them, I'm going to try to respond in the best possible way I can towards this person, people are going to tell you you're nuts, you know? They're going to say to you, hey, you know, Billy Bob just yelled at you. Why didn't you nail him? Why didn't you yell back? Why don't you let him get away with that? It's going to be like that, you know. The spiritual behavior, particularly higher spiritual behavior, is extremely divergent with social norms, you know. And you have to be willing to just go your own way, you know. You have to, in some way, have a strong conviction in your own mind that what you're doing is really... I want to say right, you know, but that's a loaded term. You have to have a strong conviction based upon logic, reasoning, and understanding that you are doing the right thing for the right reasons. And you have to be willing to take the heat that comes from other people who disapprove of that, you know. And that's the way it is. Okay. Deb. How does your perception of someone else? Yeah. So the question is, how does your perception... So this goes back to your question. You had a perception that your peers disapproved of you. And how, where does that come from? Is that the question? Why is it like that? Is that the question? Yeah, sure, yeah. So Debbie's point was, well, if you're sitting there and you're seeing someone tell you that you're a jerk because you didn't, you know, stab back when someone stabbed at you, the simple fact that you heard someone make that comment was a non-virtue ripening from your past. If you, you know, if you hear someone say, hey, you were really a loser because you treated that person kindly when they were unkind to you, you know, having someone discourage you from virtue is a negative karmic seed of the past ripening at that moment. So it's like that. Yeah. Yeah, you definitely got the right idea. The question was, is it possible to, you know, stand up and say, you know, I'm breaking with my former ways, and, you know, as of now, I hereby declare, you know, I am doing virtue and, you know, gonna wipe out all of the negativity that I've done, all of the past destructive behaviors that I engaged in. I, as of now, renounce them and will no longer engage in them, you know. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the idea behind this. That's exactly how you destroy these negative karmic seeds. You know, when we had these little negative karmic seeds here, and it, you know, when I erased them, what I was really doing was karmic purification practice. So, you know, there are two possible ways you get rid of negative karmic seeds. One is they ripen and you experience a very unpleasant result, and then they're used up. You know, for example, somebody screams at you until they can't scream anymore, until they're over it, you know, and that's the completion of that karmic seed, and it's finished, you know, it's done, it's gone. The energy behind it has been consumed, has been used, and the karmic seed is done. It's dissipated. The second and only other way to get rid of these negative karmic seeds is to do karmic purification practice, which, as I understand, they did at the last class. Is that correct? So there's, just to recoup it very quickly, there it's called four powers, the four forces, and there are four components which must always be present for you to effectively destroy negative karmic seeds. You know, you need to think first. Well, this is not one of the elements, but you have to think specifically about what it is that you're wanting to clean out. You know, let's say you killed someone, let's say, you know, you beat the pulp out of someone, or, you know, you spoke badly to someone today. You know, how do you get rid of that negativity that's now configured your mind, you know, for the future? How do you get rid of that? How do you neutralize it? How do you undo it? You know, in many ways, it's analogous to physics. It's kind of silly, but, you know, I mean, take a standard sine wave, or, you know, any wave. You know, you have to cancel that out. How do you cancel that out? You know, you cancel that out with something which is, you know, which is the opposite. You know, and they neutralize each other. It's the same principle. You know, if you have a thought which is, I really hate that guy, you need to have an opposing thought which is sort of the equal and opposite thought, to neutralize the thought which you have. I mean, that's the basic idea. You know, you can't just say, gee, you know, I shouldn't have done that, shucks, not enough. You know, it's not a direct antidote, you know. It's not going to adequately cancel out what you did. It might weaken it a little bit, you know, might dissipate it a little bit. But you have to have four things. One is, the first is, you have to remember that you want to be living based upon goodness, you know. You have to remember that the purpose of my life, the reason why I interact with people, is so that I can help them in some way. You know, that's what I'm here for. The second thing you have to remember is, well, I shouldn't say remember, but the second thing you have to feel is, I really didn't want to do that, you know. I really regret doing that. I wish I hadn't done that. I mean, there has to be some, and I'm not talking thinking, you know. This is an internal process. You have to, in your being, on some level, feel from your heart bad that you did it, you know. Can't be like, well, gee, I shouldn't have done that. Okay, well, I won't do it again. Okay, not enough. Because when you did the deed, usually and almost always, it's based upon an emotional impulse, you know. You react viscerally to do non-virtue, usually. So the antidote, the equal and counter-opposite force, has to also be just as visceral and just as strong and just as opposite. So, like that. So that's the feeling of regret. And then the third thing that has to be present is some resolution that you're not going to do it again. You know, it's not enough to just feel badly that you did it for today and then tomorrow go off and do the same thing again. You know, you have to actually modify your behavior. You know, you have to actually pay attention closely to your undertakings and to your thoughts and to your deeds, and you have to catch yourself doing those things, and you have to stop yourself. It's, you know, it's what you refer to as pronouncing the end of that behavior. Then you got to follow through on it, you know. And then the fourth thing that you have to do is you have to undertake or engage in some kind of activity to make up for the negativity, the negative thing you did, you know. If you yelled at somebody, go apologize to them, you know. The most powerful, there are many, 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 and that's the antidote. There are many, many, many different antidotes. And the most powerful antidote is to study the emptiness and to meditate upon the emptiness of the event and how the karma will come back to you and how you are actually creating your own suffering in the future by treating someone badly now. You know, that's the most powerful antidote. Which gets us back to this. You know, if you're treating everyone well all the time, you are creating your own happiness for the future. It's just that simple. You know, every time you have a perception of yourself being kind to someone, you are creating your future happiness. You know, every time you think a helpful or a virtuous thought, you are creating your own future happiness. It's just that simple. It's based on perceptual theory, which it's a little too deep to go into tonight, but that's the general idea. Yeah, Rebecca. Why doesn't karma ripen instantly? Some karma does ripen instantly. The question was, why doesn't karma ripen instantly? Karmic ripenings are classified into three categories. Karma which ripens in the next life, and karma which ripens in future lifetimes, after the next... Okay, I'll say it more precisely. These guys are... Here, I'll give you this. Just kidding. So this karma which ripens in the very next life. Shush. I'm doing them out of order. They're telling me to do them in the correct order. The correct order is karma which ripens in this life, karma which ripens in the next life, and karma which ripens in all future lives after that. So that's the linear order. So going back to your question, why doesn't karma ripen instantly? Some karmas do. The majority do not. Why is that the case? Karmas are actually made up of different components. If you have a karma, it's made up of several different things. And those elements determine how fast karma ripens, how powerfully it ripens, and yeah, I'll just leave it at that. One of the elements, one of the components of a karma is, let me go into some of the, I don't want to get too far off track, but I'll go into some of the components of karma, which determine how fast it ripens. One is, what object did you engage? Did you engage an inanimate object? Did you kick a rock and curse at a rock? You know? Or was it your dog? Or was it your wife? You know? Or was it your teacher or a holy being, right? Each of those objects is more powerful than the next, you know? And the thing that makes them powerful is their ability to benefit other beings or to benefit you specifically. So that's the first element of what makes a karma ripen quickly. What kind of object did you engage? You know, was it a powerful object, a holy object, an important object to you? Another element that makes a karma ripen more or less quickly is how passionately did you engage the object? Were you totally juiced? Were you totally impassioned? Were you absolutely enraged? Were you absolutely enraptured when you engaged this object? So if it was a very intense feeling which you engaged the object with, it also causes the karma to ripen more quickly. Or was it, and we all know this from our spiritual practice, was it, well, let me do a little practice today. You know, I think I'll do a little meditation and maybe I'll do some study and I'll try to do a little virtue today and I hope I can do some, you know. Is it that kind of, you know, like sort of light motivation? Because if it was, it's going to take a long time to ripen. So, and again, that's, you know, that's just another reason to be very inspired, you know, and juiced about your practice. It's very important to be juiced about your practice. If you in your spiritual practice are taking a sort of lackadaisical, I'll try a little bit here, I'll try a little bit there, you know, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. There's no juice behind it, you know. There is no intensity behind it, and it will take a long time for any results to occur. You know, for those karmic seeds which you're planting in doing your practice, those karmic seeds will not ripen for a long, long time, and you're going to be sitting there wondering, well, how come I'm not having any realizations? Well, that's the reason, you know. There will be some result a long time in the future. So it's like that. There is a cue. There is a cueing process as to which karmas ripen in which order, and the most powerful karmas ripen first. So if you do something with great intensity towards a holy object, the other thing I didn't mention is if you do it repeatedly, over and over and over again, it's going to ripen real quick. Like maybe in 10 minutes, maybe in 2 minutes, maybe in a day, maybe in a month. So that's what determines why karmas ripen slowly or fastly and whether you get them instantly. Okay? It's like that. Okay. Yeah. So the question or the statement was, well, given that everyone is interconnected in some way, it's not such a selfish thing to want to help people because, you know, everyone's interconnected, so by helping other people, you help yourself in a way? It's like that? So, you know, he was saying, well, you know, a lot of people just do good deeds because they don't want to burn in hell, you know. And, you know, the thing that attracted him to Buddhism was that you're actually trying to help other people for other people's sake, something like that. And, you know, on some levels I'd like to defer from answering your question because I don't want to turn you off, but I have to, so have to address it. There are several levels you can address it on, you know. On the most straightforward level, on the most direct level, you could say, look, every single perception you have is a result of how you treat everyone or every living being around you. And so it's ultimately selfish. You know, if you are a knowledgeable Buddhist, you know that if you say a kind word to someone, you're going to get a good result sometime in the future. You can't get much more selfish than that. However, it's also ultimately kind to everyone else. The two are not mutually exclusive, you know. It's possible to have both. It really is. You know, it's possible to really care about everyone sincerely. You must, if you're a bodhisattva, if you're engaging in bodhisattva activity. You must sincerely care about everyone else. It doesn't mean that you can't do it because you know it's going to help yourself. You can do both. You really can. On a more subtle level, if you understand the nature of perception, you realize that you are perceiving everything through your own filters. And every single perception you're having is a function of your own mind and how it's working. And in a way, you know, you are responding to your own mind, if that makes sense. I don't want to go into it too much, but, I mean, you could say that, I mean, let's say there's energy floating around here, some atoms, some data, whatever you want to call it. Your senses are taking that in. Your mind is processing it into a person, you know, that you like or don't like, and then you're treating that person nicely or badly. Well, in fact, if you think about it deeply, and you have to really think about it, your mind has just taken in a data set, constructed it into something, projected that back out onto the data, and then you're interacting with that based upon your mind's projection. In a sense, you are interacting with your own mind. You know, if you're treating someone that you're seeing well, you're interacting with your own mind's projections. You're interacting with yourself. So I'll leave it there. Not going to say any more about it. Sorry, go ahead. Sorry. If someone is born? Yeah. The question is, if someone is born deformed, is that the ripening of a karmic seed? Yes, the answer is very simply yes, you know. If you accept that there are infinite past lives, we all have billions and trillions of karmic seeds waiting to ripen. And depending upon how those karmic seeds configure themselves, they will ripen into, your karmic seeds do ripen into your body, you know, your world, and your perceptions. So if you have done, you know, negative karmas of destroying life, you know, disfiguring life, then you will have the result of having your life limited or shortened or destroyed in some way. It's a direct correlation. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah, Rebecca. If a child is born deformed, so the question is, if a child is born deformed, can you say that the karma really is the karma of the parents as well as the child? Every single person that ever sees that deformed being is having a karma, is having a karma, how would I say it? Everyone who sees that deformed being is having a negative karma ripening because they're having a perception of a deformed being. Some sort of order? So the idea is that this brings to the point of collective karma or things like that. Why is it that 10,000 people will see this deformed being over the course of that being's life? It's because those 10,000 people have all engaged in some karma in the past to have that result. You know, either together, they may have been 10,000 people in an army who, you know, shot somebody or blew off somebody's arm or whatever. You know, and they each have their own personal karmic seeds, which they are personally experiencing over time as they're meeting deformed beings or becoming deformed themselves or something like that. Yeah, yeah, Mike. Oh no, somebody, Petra. Yeah. Right. It's true. There's a presumption. The presumption is that seeing a deformed being would be an unpleasant experience. You know, if being a deformed being is an unpleasant experience, then it's a negative karma ripening. If you have a great interaction with a deformed being, it's a virtue. It's a positive karma ripening. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and so the other point which was made was, look, you know, just because you and I are seeing this person as deformed doesn't mean that everybody that meets this being is seeing them as deformed. You know, His Holiness could be looking at this person who we see as being deformed and could see them as Manjushri, or could see them as, you know, Yamantaka or any other enlightened being or deity completely. An enlightened being does not have any unpleasant perceptions and perceives everything as blissful. You know, so they would see that exact same being as being somebody incredible, as being somebody great, like that. So that's the idea. Yeah. 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 Wow. So Mercedes said, don't slander the Catholics because she was raised in a convent and she didn't fear hell while she was there. It was only when she became a Buddhist that she feared hell. Point well taken. And additionally, that you know, you should really, you know, look very carefully at you know, these things. And never mind. we got the message. Yeah. So the question is, well, what happens in the case of a country where, you know, there's mass genocide, or a large group of people where, you know, Cambodia, you know, two million people exterminated by the Khmer Rouge, you know, or pick any large group of people which has got a big negativity ripening upon them. How is it that it happens to all those people at the same time in the same way, more or less? And yeah, that is the answer. The answer is, you know, those people all engaged in something in the past where they planted a seed to be killed, or to be tortured, or to be whatever the result was that they experienced. And it is the karma ripening, a collective karma, you know? I mean, it gets a little dicey at this point, and it's a Friday night class, and I maybe shouldn't go so far, but there is the concept of collective karma means that everyone has done a similar thing to have a similar perception and a similar experience. Why is it that almost everyone on this planet sees the sun come up the same day? Not the same day, in the same way every day? Why is it that we all see the sun come up every day? Is it because the sun is just there and it has nothing to do with our karma? No, everything comes from our karma and perceptions. There are people on the planet who never see the sun and have never seen the sun. So, you know, however many billions of people have a collective karma where they've done something, I don't know what it would be, to perceive the sun every day. And there are those people who never have seen the sun or may not see it for 10 years because they're in a dark prison, you know? Yeah, Mike. The expansion of karma? The laws of karma?
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure the question. Yeah. You mean emanating, multiplying? I'm not sure the. Yeah. You should imagine that you are offering vast quantities, you mean? Yeah. So, Michael, if I understand you correctly, and you could let me know, is when you're doing some kind of virtue, you want to do as much as possible, right? Well, you have to specify what you mean when you say multiply it. I'm not... Well, I can try. No, I think Michael is saying that, you know, you want to, something to the effect of, you want to accumulate as much virtue as possible, and one of the ways that you can do that is to multiply your deeds. And, you know, there are different ways to try to multiply your deeds. You can do it through visualization, meditation. You know, if you're meditating and imagining that you're giving, making offerings, or helping someone, you know, you could just practice in meditation. You know, you can visualize yourself emanating many, many, many bodies and helping many, many, many beings. Or after you've done some kind of good deed, you know, you can try to increase the energy behind that, or the potential of that. Try to make it as great and vast an act as possible, as powerful an act as possible. Something like that?
Yeah. I don't understand.
That
I cannot understand.
Understand which?
It has this effect that just by I thinking I multiply it,
yeah.
that it is multiplied.
Right. So
have anything
right.
to say about that.
Yeah, okay, now I've got you. So the question is you know, is it the point is that it's said that you can multiply or increase your positive results by wanting to, essentially, by imagining it, right? Something like that. By just saying, I want the results to multiply. And how does that work? One of the laws of karma is that karma automatically expands, you know, almost exponentially. Every day, the outcome doubles in magnitude. And that's one of the natural laws of karma. But your question is, how do you just willfully say, I want this to be a greater result. The only thing I don't know the correct answer. I can only speculate. And the only thing that I could speculate about is to say, you by saying I want this to be a really big outcome, that you are increasing the juice behind the karma. You know, you are making it a more powerful karma, you know, by having a lot of intensity or a lot of emotional feeling or a lot of wishing or willfulness. That would be my only thing I could propose, would be that if you sit there and you say, well, you know, I did a good deed and I'm glad, that's one thing, and that's one intensity of action, as opposed to if you sit there and you say, man, I'm really glad I did this. First of all, you're rejoicing, you know, which increases the karmic result. And you say, man, I really want da 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 da. I think you're simply increasing the intensity of the undertaking. I mean, that would be just my logical answer. Yeah.
There are certain days which are karma has been multiplied.
Right.
How's this explained?
Yeah, how's it explained? Got me, man. I never understood that stuff. I mean, the answer was, you know, the question was, you know, there are certain days in the Buddhist system, they say, well, on this day, the karma, if you do something on this day of the calendar, you know, the karmic outcome is a million times more powerful. I don't know. You know, I never could understand that, how that works. Oh my God, this is snowballing. Yeah. So the question is, while the Buddha was, when the Buddha was close to being enlightened, and he was...
No, not when he was close to being enlightened, before his karma, before
his death. Oh, okay. I don't know those Sanskrit terms.
He died because he was supposedly against the Buddha, and that was spoiled.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm saying, the way that I learned is, he did have a stomach ache.
Yeah.
He had an unpleasant
sensation. Yeah. So the question is, you know, after the Buddha was enlightened, before he died, you know, he ate something, he felt ill, you know, he died, something like that. According to Buddhist scriptures, the Buddha manifested many, many, many things like that as teachings, you know, to teach people something or to demonstrate something to people. I mean, according to Buddhism, once you're enlightened, it is not possible for you yourself to experience any sensation of unpleasantness. If you believe His Holiness the Dalai Lama is an enlightened being or a holy being, is it possible for him to be upset? Is it possible for him to have a toothache or to be sleepy in the morning or groggy in the morning? No. His experience of himself, when he looks in the mirror, is unique to his perception. You know, when he looks in the mirror, probably he's seeing a blissful sight. We, when we see him, are seeing something else. So when the Buddha had something to eat and felt a stomach ache and got sick and died, did he himself, to his own mind, have that experience of a stomach ache and getting sick and dying? Or was that something that we, those people at that time, experienced through their perception?
I just think we have to clarify something with the language here. The way that you're framing it is you keep saying he. Now, of course, from the Theravada point of view, there is no self for anybody. So an enlightened being would not be, you know, like reflexively experiencing it as happening to a self, like to me. But that doesn't mean that the Buddha would not be experiencing unpleasant sensations. He just, according to that lineage, would not be like referring it back to a separate self.
Yeah, so you're referring to the terminology used. Does he see himself as a self-existent being? How does he refer to himself? Those sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, I do think this is controversial, that according to that tradition, he can experience unpleasant sensations, but he doesn't suffer in the way that people do, say, like, why me, this is me, you know, it's a very different perspective on what the experience is. It's just unpleasant sensations, you know, pleasant sensations, unpleasant sensations, hot, cold, you know, all these different things, but that the suffering is not the same as the universe.
For enlightened being. Yeah, it's completely different. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So her comment was, if you want to increase the power of your deeds and your karma, there are some other things you can do. One is by taking vows, you increase the power of your virtue or non-virtue if you break them. By saying, I refuse to kill anything, ever. That's a very strong statement. And then when you, in fact, refrain from killing something, it's a much more powerful action than just sort of occasionally remembering not to kill something, say. So that is a much more powerful karma. And then the other point was, well, if somebody's yelling at you and you empathize with them or remember about karma and emptiness or for whatever reason decide not to yell back at them and respond in kind, that is a great virtue, that's a powerful virtue. And in fact, it's one of the bodhisattva vows, is to not respond to like with like in a non-virtuous way. So people, even with the basic Praktimoksha vows and keeping the 10 non-virtues, not doing the 10 non-virtues, people often think that if you just go through the day, you're not supposed to kill, steal, etc. People think that if you just go through the day and you don't happen to kill anything, that, you're keeping your 10 non-virtues nicely. But it actually means when you are faced with a situation to do it, when you're faced with an opportunity to swat the fly and the impulse to swat the fly, that you rein it in and you check it and you restrain yourself and you don't do it. At that point, you have just kept one of your vows, and it is a very powerful thing. Yeah, it's like that. So that's the idea. So, okay, you guys ask a lot of questions. I didn't even start to get into the real content here. This was the simple, basic overview to explain why do virtue and non-virtue. The point of this chapter is to get into how do you know what non-virtue and virtue is. How do you know what's good? How do you know what's not good? And just one thing I want to say quickly before we take a break, because it's break time, is that there are two great categories in Buddhism of things. And, all of the problems of the world, all of the sufferings of the world come from basic confusion about these two categories. On this side, you have all of the things which are supposed to, it's called things to be taken up. And on this side, you have all of the things which are to be given up. And all of the activities of the world, all of the thoughts, deeds, and speech of the world are divided into these two categories. Things to pursue, things to avoid. And the basic problem of our lives and of existence is we don't understand what goes in what category. What is it that you're supposed to be pursuing to have good results for yourself? What is it that you're supposed to be avoiding to have good results for yourself? It's the basic problem of our world is we think that by, being a little more clever or by maybe lying once in a while, that's the way to get ahead. And that's the way most people live their lives. And that is the source of all the suffering in the world. It's simply not understanding what you're supposed to be pursuing and what you're supposed to be avoiding. And that's what this chapter is about. This chapter is a conversation between Master Guna Prabha, who is the master of Vinaya, things to give up and take up, and the adept in the garden who doesn't understand, you know, why things are the way they are in the world. So, after the break, we'll get into a little bit about his talk on, you know, how to figure out what to pursue and what to avoid and why. I'm sorry, what's what? There's schedules in the back. You can check it out. I believe there's no class next Friday, but you should check on the schedule. Well, I'll look on the schedule. I don't know. What is? There is no class on the 6th? There is definitely no class on next week, I'm told. Take a break. What is the cause to hear squealing? What is the karmic cause for... What's the karmic cause for being hot? Any ideas? I don't have any idea. So at this point in the chapter, the unknown person who's speaking to Master Gunaprabha is saying, you know, well, I get the idea that if you have good imprints in your mind, then you experience the world as pleasant. I get the idea that if you have bad imprints in your mind, you experience the world as unpleasant. But how do you tell which is which? You know, how do you know if you do this, you're going to get a good result? And how do you know if you do that, you're going to get a bad result? How are we supposed to figure that out? Because a lot of people say, look, you know, if you lie, you're going to get a good result, you know? Or if you're the trickiest, slickest guy, you know, and can fool everybody, you know, you'll get some good results. So how do we know what to do? How do we know what's what? So we got to figure out, you know, these two divisions, you know, what things to give up and what things to take up. And in Buddhism, by definition, good deeds and bad deeds, virtue and non-virtue are, by definition, described as, we'll have to do them one at a time. Good deeds are by definition described as anything which will bring you personally a pleasant result in the future on an ultimate level. And bad deeds are described as anything you do, say, or think which will bring you personally a suffering or a pain or an unpleasant result at some point in the future. Now, this is where the confusion arises, because some people think that if they lie, that will bring them a good result. You know, they'll get to get what they want at someone else's expense, basically. And according to Buddhism, you know, if you do anything where you have a perception of yourself taking advantage of someone or hurting someone or putting someone down, then that will imprint your mind to have a perception in the future of yourself being treated the same way, except a lot worse. Okay, that's one of the laws of karma, is that the karma expands and grows over time. It's not a one-for-one correlation. It's not that you yell at somebody and you get yelled at back. It's you yell at somebody and you get, like, you know, by the time the karma grows and ripens, it's 100 times worse or some great magnitude worse than the deed which you did. So they say that the karma of killing a mosquito within a period of a day has ripened in magnitude to the equivalent of killing a human being. The karma expands so fast. It's exponential. So, and that's why it's important to purify karma as quickly as possible, because you don't want to have the karmic seeds expanding in their impact over time. You know, you want to clean them out as quickly as possible. So, and that's why Jason Kapa, I think it was, would carry his stupa around with him on his horse, and every time he had a bad thought, he would stop his procession, you know, get off the horse. Tisha, thank you. He would get off the horse and, you know, do his prostrations and do his purification practice, you know, within moments of having had a thought, because he knew that within a day, that thought would be a massive, would have a massive ramification for his future. So that's what's like that. Yeah. Why does karma expand? Do I know? No, I don't. but it's a good question. I would recommend to save it for Geshe-la Michael when he comes back next time. Yeah. You can use analogies to try to understand it, to be able to logically explain it. You can use a parallel to planting seeds, you know. You could say, well, every seed works that way, you know. You could say, if you plant a seed for a redwood tree, you know, it weighs a gram or whatever, you know, and a redwood tree weighs tons, you know. To good deeds as well, yeah, to all karmas, yeah. Yeah, good deeds expand also. All right, good job, Andrea. Now everybody rejoice in Andrea's good deeds, so you can all share in this karma, okay? Yeah, this is applied karma, see? Did you set that up? Where were we? Expanding karma, yeah, and the same is true of virtuous karma, so it's the same principle. If you do a good deed, it becomes massively powerful by the time that it ripens in the future, you know? I mean, that's, you know, there are these stories of the bodhisattva who, you know, who just walked around the Buddha, you know, with reverence, you know? And that ripened as some kind of, like, massive, amazing life that he had, you know, for the whole, he had this incredible circumstance for his entire life, you know, at some point in the future, just because he walked around the Buddha once with reverence, you know, in a circle. I didn't want to say he was jumping on one foot, but, you know, it's like that. The story is he was hopping on one foot around the Buddha, and he had the right attitude, and it was a great, powerful karma. Okay, so what they start to do in this is, you know, they start to go into the specific karmas. They say, all right, well, you know, what about all the people in the world who die horrible deaths, who die early deaths? What about the children which die? You know, what about people who are good people who die? You know, I mean, what causes it? Why does it happen to them? You know, and Master Gunaprana says, well, they killed, you know. Killing is the karmic cause for having a shortened lifespan. If you kill any living being, then you yourself will have a shortened lifespan, you know. And, you know, I've seen it written, and I've heard it said, you know, the way in which you walk down the street, you know, the way in which, if you're in the woods, the way in which you walk down the path, you know, do you pay attention to where you're walking, you know, or do you just kind of, you know, not really thinking about, are you killing anything as you're walking around? And it's not to be compulsive, by no means. It's not to be like, oh my God, I can't walk down the street because I might kill something. It's not like that. But the point is it in your mind? Are you thinking about it? Is it deeply rooted in your consciousness, in your mind, that you will not kill anything and you will pay attention that you don't kill anything? You can't. Yeah. Right. It's true. It's a real problem, you know? I mean, the question is, how can you avoid killing anything, right? If you're alive, you're going to kill something, you know? If you're eating vegetables, things are dying because you're eating the vegetables, you know? All of the bugs that get killed in the planting, you know, the spraying, the harvesting. It's one of the limitations of this realm of existence, you know? It's one of the basic and implicit problems. Yeah, it's a very good question. The question is, if you know that as long as you're alive, that you're killing, you know, that things are dying as a result of your existence, then how could you ever escape, you know? How could you ever possibly, you know, have completely pure karma? And first of all, you know, you have to start at the coarse level. You have to stop having a perception of yourself personally involved in killing, you know? And then you have to work on a more refined and a more refined and a more refined level. You know, you have to, with all of these karmic elements, you have to work from coarse to subtle. You know, you have to say, you know, if I perceive myself directly going up to a human and killing them, you know, through an abortion or through stabbing them or whatever, very, very heavy negative karma. You know, if I perceive myself paying the butcher to go out in the backyard and I don't see it to slaughter the veal, you know, so I get some fresh veal, heavy karma, not as heavy as doing it yourself, you know. If you don't pay anybody to ever kill anything so that you can eat, but you know that, you know, somewhere along the line, supply and demand is happening here, it's still, you know, you still have that awareness, you still have that perception. It's a lighter karma, but still the karma. Yeah. You know, I can't really, from from a position of logical good conscience, I can't really say, you know, that, well, you could ever not have a perception as a human being of needing to eat. And again, this is getting a little speculative and far field, but, you know, when you read stories of great meditators, you know, they don't much eat, you know. The advanced meditators have practices where they live on, you know, the essence of plants or even less than that, you know, when they're very, very advanced meditators. So the only thing that I can really say is that you progress from coarse to subtle, you know, in your activities and in your engagement. And you have to start at the coarse level to eliminate killing. And you have to try to make that more and more refined and more subtle to the extent of your capacity. And it is one of the implicit limitations of the human realm is that you have to eat and that things die so that you can eat. Yeah, no way around it. Yeah, Michael. Well, guys, I'm afraid I'm... I'm afraid I'll have to ask you guys to do the classic vegetarian debate after class together. Okay. Okay. So then the next question he asks is... we did death. You know, he says, well, it seems that negative actions produce positive results, you know. How do you know that if you steal from someone that you're going to lose money in the future? How do you know that the laws of karma are true? You know, how do you know that good always produces good? And as Bonnie said, you know, you can use the analogy of seeds which are planted in regular life. You know, you don't get cherries from corn seeds. The same is true of the laws of karma. You don't get good results from bad deeds. It just doesn't make any logical sense in the physical world, and the same holds true on a karmic level. One question that was asked to me during the break by this lady was, how do you know that the laws of karma are true? How do you know that the laws of karma actually hold? I mean, this is all great, you know, great theory, great speculation, great philosophy, but, you know, it's just talk. So how do you know that it's true? How do you know that it's the case? And on a very basic level, you have to, you can only say, look at all the possible options. Does stealing always produce money or wealth or whatever it is you're stealing? Does giving always produce wealth? Does lying produce wealth? You have to look at all the possible options, you know? And you have to say, do any of those options ever, consistently and without exception, ever produce the same outcome? The answer is no. You know, I would ask anyone in this room if they can think of any possible methodology or undertaking to produce wealth which, without exception, every time you engage in it, produces wealth. You know, I don't say there is none. I mean, you can't say invest this way or invest that way or work this way or work that way or save this way or save that way, because, you know, people have tried all the permutations and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, you know. So what's the possibility? What's left? You're left with either the possibility that life is a random walk in the park where things just happen and sort of pop up for no apparent reason and just, you know, live that way and kind of just say, well, it's all random, man. I'm going to just seize the day and do whatever I can get away with and do what I feel like at any given moment. But that's not how we live. You know, that's not the scientific principle. That's not the modern principle of life. You know, the modern principle of life is everything has a cause. It can be understood. And you can show that the same causes produce the same outcomes consistently. So what Buddhism does is say, look, use logic, you know. Eliminate every other possible alternative. What's left? The only thing that exists than anyone could even conceive of as an option is that giving always produces wealth, and there's a time lag, and that's the only possible logical explanation left, and no one can come up with anything else at all in any way to offer any consistent explanation other than this. Therefore, you either accept that life is a random walk in the park, random events, or you accept this explanation because nobody can think of one in all of history better than this. So that's from a logical perspective all that we could say to prove the laws of karma. Now, on an experiential level, you have to set out to prove to yourself that the laws of karma are true. You know, the only way to really have certain knowledge, strong conviction that the laws of karma are true, is if you go out and you do it, you know, and you do it seriously, and you do it thoroughly, and you do it in a knowledgeable, informed, and thorough way. It's the only way you're ever going to believe it. I could sit up here and give you a logical proof, maybe, or not, or give you whatever explanations, but in the end, you know, it's talk. The only thing that means anything to people in the end is their personal experience, you know? I mean, that's my feeling. I think it's true. If you're going to buy into something, you got to have an experience that it works, you know? And the only way you're going to have an experience is to put some toes in the water and give it a go and see what happens. So, I mean, that's really all I can say to that point in the end. Try it, you know? And it's true of any spiritual path, you know? If your spiritual path is not producing happiness, more happiness for you, or results for you, or better results for you, you ought not be doing it, you know? It's not a valid spiritual path. Either the teachings are wrong, your practice is wrong, or the teacher is presenting it wrong, you know? You know, you have to check it out, and you have to decide which of those are possible, you know? And if it doesn't work, then you shouldn't be doing it, because the purpose of a spiritual path is to improve your life, you know? Is to improve your future, you know, your infinite future. So it's like that. Okay, what was... I don't know if I'm going to go through all this, but let's see. What about relationships, he asks. Ooh, that's a good one. Does anybody have any ideas what the cause of a good relationship is, karmically? What would be the cause of having a relationship where you're very... Well, you have a partner who is extremely loving, extremely giving, extremely thoughtful, extremely kind. Been here? Bingo! It's treating the other person that way. It's kind of hard, huh? However, if you see a relationship, or if you have a relationship where there's ill will, divisiveness, harsh speech, attacking, backstabbing, distrust, the other person being stolen, well, that's another whole matter. you know, generally, it's because you haven't behaved that way yourself in the past. You know, if you walk around, or if you even have in your mind this thought of, you know what, I'm better than everybody else. I'm a really special person, and no one's quite as good as me, and I really think this person's got that wrong, and this person's got that wrong, and they're really not very good in this way, and you know, it's like that person really doesn't have it together in that way. You know, if you have this going on in your mind on a subtle level where you're constantly thinking that there's something wrong with other people, or judging other people, or feeling like, you know the feeling of like, well, I'm really better than them. That is the karmic cause for being alone. That is the karmic cause for not having a relationship. That is the karmic cause for not being closely connected to another person or people. And you have to look at your life, you know. You've got to look at your life and say, what is my life like right now? You know, what are the circumstances of my life? And then, because this is about your life, you know. This is about your personal day-to-day experiences, you know. Are people connecting to me deeply, you know? Do I have people who really love me? You know, am I really close to people? Are people really close to me? You know, am I happy, you know, with my finances? Am I happy with my job? Am I happy with my partner? If not, you really got to look at it on a case-by-case basis, you know, and say, all right, I don't like my relationship. I don't like that I have or don't have a relationship. I don't like the way my relationship is because of, you know, we don't like each other very much. We're not nice to each other. And you got to be willing to take the lead, you know. You got to be willing to say, okay, this person is going to perceive me however they're going to perceive me. It's based upon their personal karma and perceptions and past deeds. I'm going to perceive this person in my own way, which is unique to my past deeds and my past karma. And if I ever want to have things improve, either with this person or anyone else, then I have to, starting right now, change my behavior and change my thoughts in relation to this person today, you know, and all day long today, and all day long tomorrow, and every day hereafter. I got to start with the person that's closest to me, and after I got that down pat, then I got to move on to the next person that's closest to me, and then expand this to the circle of people around me, so that all of those behaviors of judgmentalism and condescension and superiority, or, you know, subtle aggression or manipulation or whatever it is that, you know, everybody's got going on in a relationship, you got to stop it. You know, if you don't stop it, if you don't start treating the other person like the most special person in the world, you'll never be treated that way. I mean, it's that simple. And frankly, this is the essence of the highest teachings of Buddhism. This is the essence of tantric teachings. You know, the essence of tantric teachings is that you must behave 24 hours a day towards every single being as if they were the holiest being that exists. You must behave towards everyone you ever meet in as pure a way as possible, all the time, 24 hours a day. You know, of course, then there's all kinds of techniques and such to learn to do that. But that is the essence of tantric teachings. That is the essence of tantric practice. And, you know, that's it. That's the only way to get enlightened. That's the only way to do virtue 24 hours a day, is to think that every single person I meet all the time, man, I got to serve them ultimately in every way I possibly can to my maximum capacity. We got, you know, everyone has limitations. We do the best we can. Yeah. So there's the very real issue of, you could be treating people well all day long and they could be, you know, really nasty to you. And what do you do with that? You know, how do you handle that? How do you respond to that? Everyone has a capacity. You know, this is in Master Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. You as a bodhisattva are required to only do as much as you're comfortable with. You may not do more than you're capable of. You'll be breaking your bodhisattva vows. You know, you must gauge your capacity, and you must know yourself well enough to say, you know what, this is not positive for me. You must be able to say, you know what, you have to know your motivation, you know. You have to be able to say, I am doing this out of goodness. I am doing this to help this person, and I feel positive that I'm helping this person. I feel good that I'm helping myself and helping this person. And when it gets to the point where you don't feel like you're where it's healthy for you, or where you're benefiting yourself, or you're benefiting the other person, then you've reached the limit of your capacity and you have to stop. You know? You have to. In Master Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, he says, look, high bodhisattvas can cut a chunk of meat off of their arm, you know, and give it to someone that's hungry, and they'll have no regrets and they'll feel no pain. You know? That's their capacity. You don't have that capacity. We don't have that capacity. You know, you can maybe give a few potatoes and a few carrots out of your food, you know. Do that and be content with that. You know, be satisfied with that. And as your capacity increases, you can do more. But don't try to do something which is beyond your capacity. So that would be the answer. It's a very common Buddhist thing, actually, to say, I'm going to sacrifice myself. I'm going to just, you know, I'm going to take it all, you know. I'm just going to be good. And let them beat the crap out of me, you know. It's okay. It's virtuous, you know. It's a good thing to do, you know. It's negative karma ripening. I'm purifying my negative karma by letting them beat the shit out of me, you know. No. You know, that's not bodhisattva activity. That's not proper Buddhist philosophy. Proper Buddhist philosophy says, look, am I enabling this person to do non-virtue by being around them? You know, how do the scales weigh out here, you know? Am I enabling them to generate non-virtue towards me? Am I generating non-virtue towards them? You know, am I benefiting them in some way? Are they benefiting me in some way? Am I benefiting myself in some way? It's like that. You know, in Buddhism, there's short-term benefit and long-term benefit. And you always have to look at both of those. You have to say, if I do this, what's the short-term benefit? And if I do this, what's the long-term benefit? You know? And you have to weigh those against each other. And generally speaking, you know, you should do whatever is the greatest long-term benefit. You know? If you're in a situation, if you're in a relationship, which in the short term, maybe you're helping the person a little bit. But, you know, it's crippling your life. It's major long-term negative benefit or negative harm. And you probably ought not do it. You know, so you have to weigh it. And Buddhism does not say, be a nice guy, you know, and let other people smack you around. That is not the point of doing virtue, you know. I mean, Lama Yeshe, you know, there's a story of Lama Yeshe, you know, and he's on the train in India, and, you know, they got the baggage on the train, and, you know, the train pulls into the station, and, of course, the classic Indian guy tries to steal Lama Yeshe's bags, you know. And what does Lama Yeshe do is he grabs the guy by the back of the neck, and he picks him up, and he shakes him, and he scares the hell out of him, you know, and he severely punishes the guy. So, why did he do it, you know? Was he mad? Probably not. Was he trying to prevent the guy from accumulating negative karma towards a holy object? Probably, you know. So you have to think about it like that. You have to think. You are required as a bodhisattva to be wrathful, to be powerful, to be strong, to be aggressive, to be forceful, with the proper motivation, whenever necessary. It's part of your bodhisattva vows, and you may not let people treat you badly just because it's a habit of yours. It's very bad. Very, very bad. You must insist that you are treated as well as possible, and you must treat other people as well as possible. I mean, it's a requirement, so it's like that. So please don't get into the idea that, you know, I have to just do virtue and it doesn't matter what anybody does to me. You know, it does matter, you know. If only from the perspective that you think, you know what, I'm an aspiring bodhisattva and I am becoming a more powerful karmic object, and anything they do towards me is a heavy negative karma, and I can't permit that. If your motivation is nothing more than that, you know, look at it from that perspective. You know? Okay. So, okay, what time is it? I mean, what time? Okay, we got a little more time. So while we're on relationships, what happens if you lose your partner a lot, regularly, or once in a while, or after a decade, whatever, you know. Why does it happen? What's the karmic cause of losing your partner? You know? Any ideas? In the past, you have taken someone else's partner. You know? You have split people up in the past. You know? Whether, you know, probably someone's partner. You know? Sexual misconduct. Well, it's not quite sexual. It's a type of sexual misconduct. But what about work? You know? The adept asks Master Gunaprabha, you know, well, you know, in this case, he's working as a clerk in the library, you know, and he's got the boss who's always treating him badly, and he says, look, you know, I mean, this guy is always mistreating me, you know, I'm always trying to subtly, you know, make his life a little miserable. What's the cause of this guy always treating me badly? You know, why is this guy always treating me badly? Why is he always yelling at me? Why is he always confronting me? Why is he always telling me that I'm not doing enough work or I'm not doing good enough? You know, why the harsh words? So, and Master Gunaprabha says, well, you know, you did it in the past, you know. You spoke harshly to someone in the past. You thought harshly about someone in the past, and you are receiving the result of it. It's like that. So it's a very specific correlation that the laws of karma provide. And it's, in a way, it can be kind of, in many cases, it can be kind of easy to figure out. You know, you just think in terms of what's happening to me now, and you did something like that in the past. It's pretty specific. And if you want it to stop, if you don't want to have that kind of result in the future, if you don't want to be dumped by your boyfriend or girlfriend, you know, if you don't want to be yelled at by your boss, then, you know, you've got to purify that karma. You've got to do the four forces with those behaviors in mind, things that you've done in the past. You've got to purify those karmas, and you have to be meticulous about your behavior in the present. So it's like that. I think I'm going to wrap it and see if there's anything else that's really important. I don't think there's anything else I want to get into. It's getting late. It's hot. The last point that Master Guna Prabha makes is that basically, you know, the entire, all of the realms exist, all of the realms of existence, you know, all of the six realms of existence are one big cycle of suffering. And the reason that they're one big cycle of suffering is that we don't understand this division. You know, we don't understand this division of what to pursue and what to give up. And we're constantly doing the wrong thing. You know, we're constantly, when someone yells at us, we're constantly yelling back. You know, when someone treats us badly, we respond in kind. And it's the root of all suffering of all of the six realms. And until we learn to stop it, you know, we will have a suffering existence ourselves. So, and that is what samsara means. It's a cycle of suffering. You know, you're yelled at, you yell back. You perpetuate the suffering. It becomes a cycle. You know, it becomes this vicious cycle. And, you know, you have to learn to stop striking back. I mean, that's really what it comes down to, you know. You have to learn to be willing to take some hits, you know. You have to be willing to take the blows that are given to you. If you're going to be a serious spiritual practitioner, you know, I mean, it's really a bodhisattva warrior, you know. It's really a spiritual warrior. What it means to be a spiritual warrior is that you understand this stuff and you say, you know what? Okay, I'm going to take personal responsibility here for my life. I'm going to stop blaming everybody else. I'm going to stop making it everybody else's fault. I'm going to stop making it everybody else's problem. I mean, I'm going to say, you know what? Everything that I'm experiencing, I caused. I'm responsible for. And every time somebody yells at me, I'm just going to take it. In that, I acknowledge that I caused it. I acknowledge that I have to experience the result of what I caused. I'm going to let the karma ripen. I'm going to decide what to do. I'm going to get on with my life, you know. And I refuse to strike back. I refuse to respond in kind. You know, being a spiritual warrior means that you're willing to experience the pain, the unpleasantness, and the difficulty of somebody treating you badly and not responding in kind. That's what it is to be a spiritual warrior. It's being willing to feel shitty when somebody yells at you and just taking it in and going, man, that's pretty lousy. You know, I really don't like this. It feels really horrible. And I'm not going to make them feel that way. I'm not going to respond to them like this. I'm just going to take it because I caused it. And then I'm going to decide what my next step is. And I'm not going to respond in kind. And I'm going to just make my decision from a neutral position or from a beneficial position. And I'm going to get on with my life. That's what it means to be a spiritual warrior. It means I'm not blaming anybody else for anything except myself. And I'm taking the pain that comes to me, and I'm not striking back. And so, you know, ultimately, if you're going to become enlightened, if you're going to be a serious spiritual practitioner, that's, in my opinion, that's what you got to do. So, on that note, I will stop. We should do a little dedication, if our umze would do a little dedication. So please, again, you know, what's the point of doing a dedication? I mean, again, you've got to get out of the mode of just doing things without thinking, because you do a dedication to collect a positive karma, a positive potential. And if you sit there and you just go da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and you don't think about it, there's no energy behind it, you know? There's no power behind it. It's a very, very weak karmic seed. And the point of doing a dedication is to think very deeply and sincerely and strongly that, hey, I did something good here, and this is really important, and I really want a powerful result that's going to result in this outcome. That's the point of dedication, you know. You have to put a lot of energy behind it. You know, you have to put a lot of feeling behind it, and you have to specifically think, I really want this kind of outcome as a result of this effort and these good things that I did. So, think about it.